Welcome to the Medical Imaging for All podcast, brought to you by Clarius Mobile Health. This show is dedicated to exploring the trends and technologies shaping the future of medical imaging. Here's your host, Ohad Arazi, CEO of Clarius Mobile Health. Now, let's jump right into today's episode.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us for another episode of our podcast, Medical Imaging for All. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Chris Box, who is really one of the fathers of the point-of-care revolution in ultrasound. Chris is the chair of emergency medicine at UC Irvine, a professor of clinical emergency medicine, and has more than 110 peer-reviewed publications to his name, has edited or co-edited 3 textbooks, and has been invited to lecture over 446 invited lectures across 49 states and 19 countries. Chris, that is a lot. Wow. Could you maybe take a moment before we get any deeper, though, to tell us a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much, Ohad, for having me. You know, I got very lucky with my career that I found ultrasound, or ultrasound found me, however you want to call it. I was a resident in emergency medicine, and at some point, I decided I wanted to be in academic emergency medicine instead of community emergency medicine when I was going to finish my residency. I asked my program director, then department chair, hey, what fellowship should I do to stay in academic emergency medicine? Should I do talks, peds, you know, which one? What sounds good? EMS? Whatever you tell me to do, I'll just go do it because I really want to work in academic emergency medicine. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, you know, you should do ultrasound. And this was, in the year 2000. And so I started looking around for ultrasound fellowships, and I found one in Chicago, and I went out there. And I think I was the third person to do that ultrasound fellowship there in Chicago, and my wife and I went out there and stayed the year, and we loved it, loved Chicago. And I came back. I wasn't really sure why I was going to Chicago, frankly, because ultrasound at that point were just these gigantic boxes, you know, and I was like going to, I guess, do that at the bedside of all my patients in the ER. And that's sort of what I was relegating myself to, not knowing that this whole handheld thing was going to come down the pike in the future, or that ultrasound was going to really take over my specialty either. So, but yeah, I went out there, learned, drank it all in, loved it, and then came back to UCI. And I've been here for 22 years. Started out with like the big carts, the big trolleys, and we've sort of morphed over the years to get these machines into much smaller spaces, up on booms and in our pockets. And so, just kind of, you know, being part of that. And then somebody invited me to go to give a TED talk on it. And then I prepared a lot of that information. Then this is a number of years ago, maybe 7 years ago or so. And sort of just taking a snapshot at the time of what point of care ultrasound looked like. And just one of those things, you sort of do this TED talk, a lot of preparation and not knowing that it was going to be seen so many times by so many people. You know, I walk into my son's school and some teacher's like, oh, I saw your TED talk. I'm like, what? Why? So, yeah. And then all this ultrasound stuff. Then I started doing ultrasound medical education with school medicine, thinking, boy, it'd be sure great to integrate ultrasound throughout the 4 years of medical school. And I did that sojourn for about a decade now. And that led to other leadership roles. And that's how I kind of became a department chair. And so now I have people helping me with a lot of the ultrasound stuff. But yeah, it's been a really cool journey through. I mean, I'm still, you know, I worked in the ER over the weekend and I must have done ultrasound on 70% of my patients, just every opportunity I could. I love it. Drink it in every chance I get. Super fun. Super fun to do it clinically, super fun to teach and also do research on it. So yeah, it was that academic niche I was looking for.
You know, I love it as well. I started my career in healthcare doing PACS, like multimodality PACS. But I always had kind of this secret crush on ultrasound because it was non-ionizing and the images were just so cool. And it's so dynamic, right? And kind of as my career evolved, I ended up running an ultrasound company. But like you, I think that I can really associate with that passion for it. And that's been shared by a lot of people that have sat in your seat as guests on my podcast of just like kind of falling in love with the modality. And it sounds like you also fell in love with it at the time where so much was happening. It was a kind of this critical inflection point where really point-of-care ultrasound was being invented. For the first time, it was coming out of radiology, cardiology, and obstetrics, and was being, you know, coming into the hands of point-of-care physicians around kind of the early 2000s, right? So, and where was this in Chicago?
Is the Advocate Christ Hospital on the south side, in Oak Lawn, just south of the city there, yeah.
Super. So yeah, we'll come back to maybe a few of the things you talked about, like for example, education, which I also believe is just so foundational to helping physicians kind of cross that divide and get comfortable with the technology. But first, just from the opening, I had one question I was curious about, which is, which state have you not visited?
North Dakota is the one state that I have not taught ultrasound in. But yeah, everywhere else, including Alaska, everywhere. Yeah, I've been lucky to do that. Yeah, I should just show up to like a hospital one day and be like, hey, I'm here. Who wants to learn ultrasound?
If there's any listeners here in North Dakota, please contact the POCUS directors in your hospitals and get Chris out there. I think that just checking off that last state, it's got to be done.
Let's do it. I'll bring my team. We'll do a two-day course. I'll have some fun.
Right on. Good. And actually, just if we take a step back before you focused on ultrasound, Chris, what made you go into medicine? What was interesting about that?
Oh, to be a doctor? Just my whole life. You know, I just, since I was probably 6 years old, my grandfather was a doctor. I was a neurologist at Yale. And I remember when we lived in Connecticut, I was like seeing his doctor bag and asking questions and looking at anatomy textbooks way back when I was a little kid and just sort of always interested in it. Then I get more interested in emergency medicine. I wanted to know like what to do if somebody used to drop dead right in front of me. And I was worried that if I was, you know, a different type of doctor, I wanted to definitely like know what to do if somebody was to like, you know, keel over. I think that's what drew me towards emergency medicine, frankly. It's kind of silly, but, and then learning more about emergency medicine and the fact that, you know, we have to be able to shift gears from any patient, anytime, you know, from a dermatology issue to an ocular issue to a cardiac issue. And that's kind of point of care ultrasound. You know, it lends itself very well to, you know, not just a single organ, but like the whole body. And that's what I like about ultrasound and emergency medicine is that it definitely makes me a better doctor, lowers my threshold to consider certain types of maybe more rare conditions, but also helps me from overutilizing tests, less of a shotgun approach when I'm taking care of my patients, makes me more self-propelled, not relying as much on radiation as, you know, maybe some of my colleagues are. And it makes the job more fun, just something to do where I'm a little bit more, you know, in the patient's space, you know, putting probe to patient just necessarily requires you to really be in there with the patient and not sort of just doing medicine from, you know, the doorway, but actually like, you know, right there. So
again,
I like that sort of engagement with the patient that way. You know, most of them. And
Do you ever get patients engaged around like you're kind of pulling this tricorder style device out from your bag and now using it to make a point of care decision? Are they like, what is this thing? Are they interested at all in your handheld ultrasounds?
All the time. I'm telling them like, hey, you know, it sounds fun right now. What if we just looked under the skin and see what you're talking about? And they're like, why is this doctor acting weird? And I'm like, no, I'm going to look through your skin right now with this device. Check it out. It's coming on my phone, you know? And so I have some fun with that, talking it up a little bit. And, you know, they're usually like throwing up or in pain. They don't care to have fun, but still my trainees around me get a kick out, especially the nurses. They get a kick out of that kind of stuff. But sometimes the patients are like, they come back to the ER and they're like, oh yeah, I remember you. You're the guy that did the ultrasound on me when I was here. You know, I used to hear that a lot earlier in my career when I was working a lot more clinically. I used to get that a lot. Like, oh, you know, I remember you, doctor. You're the guy that did the ultrasound on me. And I'm looking at this person like I've never seen them before. And I'm like, okay. Yeah, cool. Okay. Yep. So yeah, so I think patients kind of remember that, you know, that like the doctor went a little step further and tried to figure it out before ordering all the tests and everything. And so, and I, you know, I try to let that be part of my clinical gestalt whenever I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm. So you've seen this journey now, right, since the early 2000s to where we are today. And you talked a bit about education. Maybe we could come back to that point. I mean, is that the key to unlocking more adoption, or maybe instead of guiding you, like what is still, you know, it makes perfect sense, right? Instead of just palpating or referring out to radiology, you can actually look inside under the skin. And yet I'd say only a fraction of doctors are pulling this out or incorporating it into their practice, either private practice, in hospital, internal medicine, emergency care, you have it. What is kind of the key to really unlocking the potential of ultrasound?
The truth is ultrasound is difficult. It's hard to learn it. I taught in 49 states. Those are a lot of one-day, two-day courses, and I show up and do the whole dog and pony show for a couple of days, teach my heart out, and frankly, realize that not only a handful of people are going to be able to really commit to it and come in on the days off and practice with it until they get good enough to feel confident. And that's the real thing. It's such an art. And so that's when I started to turn my sights about a decade ago, all the way in the beginning to medical school, when I've got 4 years, not just a couple of days. Now I've got 4 years with people. And so I can stretch the curriculum out and get them a lot of hands-on experience so that in a lot of different types of patient, you know, body habitus, so that they can get used to how hard to push, how to angle the transducer, how to, you know, that art, that becoming really comfortable with it and confident in acquiring the image. The image acquisition of all of this is the most challenging part of it. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I think a lot of physicians aren't using it is just that. They just don't feel like they're going to be confident, and they're flubbing around with the probe in front of the patient, kind of embarrassed. Whereas somebody who's good at it is excited to show the patient their organs and excited to see what they're going to see and curious about what they're going to see with it, rather than feeling nervous, like, oh, I'm just going to put on this person and I'm going to feel silly because I'm not going to really know what I'm looking at. They're going to say, what did you see, doc? And then I'm going to say, nobody wants to be caught flat-footed like that with ultrasound. So I think that's probably one of the major barriers is the educational component with it. And try as we have, I think, you know, unless it's really standard of care in medical school, so that when people get to residency, they're able to really take it then to their own specialty to the next level, regardless of what kind of doctor they're going to be. I think, you know, after 8 years, 9 years of it, then, you know, they start to get really, it becomes just fluent. They can become fluent in it. And so can you learn it post-residency? You know, you could get a taste of it in a two-day course, and then you could spend a dedicated period of time really trying to learn. In fact, we have a four-week ultrasound sabbatical here at UCI where folks can come for 4 weeks and just scan next to me in my ER, and sort of like a mini fellowship in a way. And the goal is to get 300 ultrasounds. And that's one way to kind of follow up on the image acquisition side of it. And we've had maybe 50 people or so come through that sabbatical fellowship now, and a lot of positive feedback around that. But I mean, that's expensive. You got to be able to get here, find a place to live for
four weeks out of your clinical practice.
Stop making money for 4 weeks. You know, like, it's incredibly.
So really the key is starting early, it sounds like. And that's a very interesting perspective. And I think also a very honest view of how physicians feel when they're not fully indoctrinated and maybe they're not that comfortable. And therefore it becomes something that, you know, is a deterrent. What about the role of AI? This is a topic that I'm interested in. We haven't talked much about my background, but before Clarius, I was the CEO of Zebra Medical, which was an imaging AI company that's multimodality. So principally X-ray, CT, and mammography. And I saw that historically, the imaging AI kind of vendor community was gravitating towards post-processing and like analysis, like interpretation. And then when I came into ultrasound, I said, wow, I actually think the number one application of AI is, to the point that you made, is on image acquisition, because reading it isn't anywhere as hard as acquiring it. And I think that is actually what's making AI in ultrasound much more valuable than it is in many other domains, because in radiology, at some level, and it's kind of an uncomfortable truth, but at some level, imaging AI is there to replace part of what the radiologist does. Versus here in ultrasound, it's much more of a tool to get that better acquisition, to get that comfort, to maybe have AI guide the acquisition, right? Rotate left, rotate right, red, 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 green. Boom, you've acquired the four-chamber view of the heart. Or you can automatically segment the tendon and eliminate the operator variability in performing the measurements. What's your view, Chris, on AI? Can AI really lower that threshold, that hurdle rate for novice users that are taking their first steps in ultrasound?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, if the machine would instruct the operator in its own use, that's kind of the holy grail of point-of-care ultrasound in many ways, with the closing the gap on the educational component, because the subtleties of probe movement that somebody who's really good at it sort of automatically know what to do and know where to push and how hard and how to, you know, move the patient, positioning and everything. I think you can build all that into AI to teach it what to look for and then to tell the person doing the ultrasound what to do. It looks like you're looking for a gallbladder. Have you tried telling the patient to take a deep breath? Have you tried rolling the patient onto their left side and to all the way on their left side? Have you tried getting between the ribs? You know, and then once it starts to see some image on the screen, and then it's saying, oh yeah, rotate left, rotate right, fan this way, fan
maybe
that.
It can even be tactile, you know, like putting enough pressure, not enough pressure.
I like to think of it as, imagine if you were to hand a transducer to a patient and say, here's the ultrasound probe, put it where it hurts, and then not say anything and stand back and then watch to see if the machine could like tell a complete layperson how to scan themselves. I think that would be like the ultimate consumer use of this product. And of course, all the images are being automatically, you know, sent somewhere and read or something, but at least the hard part is getting the image on the screen. And so if the AI was so basic that it could teach somebody who's a non-medical person how to scan themselves, you know, that level of basic, you know, sort of instruction, I think would truly democratize the use of this device to its fullest extent.
I think the probe positioning is probably the hardest part. Where we have tried to focus principally is on, you know, just kind of observing stenographers. And if you look at them working, right, they're constantly adjusting the knobs on their compact or on their card, right? Adjusting the gain or the depth of field and the contrast. And so could we automate that? That's really where we started with our AI journey, so that, you know, automatically, you know, that the bladder is a lot deeper than your carotid, and therefore you want a different gain, a different depth of field, right? And so if you can automatically detect the anatomy, load the right preset, that makes less fiddling. So at least you can keep your hands on the patient. And then from there, evolving it to how to position the probe. I still think there's a journey there, but certainly for someone like you, who's, you know, made a career out of educating people how to use ultrasound, I wonder if really AI and technology doesn't need to play a much more substantial role than just continuing to replicate kind of medical education of how we've done it historically. Because if we look at other consumer technologies, like I have teenage children, they've never read a manual. They would never think of attending a course on anything they do, because the machine, the AI, the UI at some level will figure out what they want to do. They'll ask, oh, looks like you're looking for that. Did you try this? Right. So like they don't have to learn it because they're figuring it out as they go along. And I think there's a role for that to be played in medical devices. And I'd love to see if really we can break through maybe more as an education tool, like AI as helping to automate more of education, as opposed to it being just a clinical research, not just, but like, I think it's principally been focused on clinical use cases, like real time, versus maybe we could actually use it to train offline much more so.
Yeah. Whenever someone's struggling with an image, I watch them. So if the probe is in their right hand, if the right hand dom, they're scanning with the right hand, their left hand's on the machine. I watch them spending way too much time with their left hand when really they've got, and I tell them, I said, no, you have a right hand problem. And I must say that 90% of the time I'm watching someone scan and they're trying to mess with the machine thinking it's a left hand problem. And I'm like, no, this is a you problem. This is a right hand problem. Or the patient needs to be positioned, you know, that kind of stuff. So you're right to say that.
Great. Well, we've talked a bit about the journey that point of care ultrasound has had. Machines have been getting smaller. They've been getting more intuitive. They're becoming more and more wireless, more portable. Ergonomics are better. Where are we relative to this journey? You've been speaking about the revolution of point of care ultrasound. How far along are we on this revolution? From here on, is it an evolution? And where else do we go from here?
Yeah. So the first steps in the revolution was a political one. And I lived that era of the revolution, the politics of this, and each specialty wanting to claim their own organ and the use of ultrasound on that organ. And since then, I think a lot of those political barriers have been broken down. And now, you know, point of care ultrasound, POCUS, it's a thing, it's in every specialty. And the stories that you hear about one particular specialty trying to curtail its use, so rare to hear a story like that. In fact, you see people react when we hear like, wait, what did they say to you? Oh, wow, that is like from another era, you know? But that era, that revolution of the political revolution, you know, I think that war has been fought and won. And to hear people still worry about that, it's like, you're the generals fighting the last war. The next war, though, is probably the educational side of it and getting it so that not only are we allowed to do it, but we're good at it and we know how to do it right and getting it in the hands of just more and more people earlier on. And I think that's kind of where the revolution currently lies, because if you look at medical student use of ultrasound, and I am the current president of Society of Ultrasound and Medical Education, and so I'm really into the use of ultrasound in medical schools and sort of taking the pulse of that. It's hard to really know how many schools are teaching it. Some of them say they teach it, but it's really just like, oh, here's how to interpret some basic ultrasounds. Here, you can go scan with the tech if you want for a day or not. Other schools, you know, are really 4 years all the way through the whole curriculum longitudinally. I just got a fresh set of interns here in emergency medicine starting this week, and we taught them ultrasound this week. There's 9 of them, and all but one really knew what they were like. The other ones didn't know how to do it at all. They were very basic, very, I hope they're not listening, but they didn't get any medical school, you could tell. I mean, just, I had to start with the true basics. And as I was doing my sort of litmus test for each one and asking them some basic questions, and it was clear to me, like, the revolution's got a long way to go here in medical education. And so because of that, we have a huge opportunity here to work with medical schools and try to standardize a curriculum and get the resources that they need. And the resources themselves, you know, it's a combination between ultrasound products, it's a that and as, you know, sort of some didactic, online didactic, and then the hands-on experiences with
staff. Is there enough faculty at the schools to be able to give that hands-on?
I truly believe there is, because every medical school has faculty in multiple different specialties. And because ultrasound is, you know, certainly widely used in my own specialty and multiple others now, you can easily cobble together some hands-on experiences with those folks. It's not, you know, you got to pay for their time to come and teach. But if you can teach the first and second years really well, by the time they become third and fourth years, particularly fourth year medical students, they get really good at teaching the basics of probe positioning and image acquisition on standardized patients. And so those fourth year medical students, at least here, now that we've had the curriculum in place for 10 years, they are my chief instructors when it comes to the junior medical students. And you know how it is when you teach ultrasound, you know, you can kind of get the image on the screen, you're getting pretty good at it, and you don't really think about it too much anymore. And then suddenly you find yourself trying to teach it, and you're like, and they ask you a question like, well, why is it when I move the probe this way, the image goes like this? And you go, you know what? Let me think about that for a second. Here's why. It's because the edge, this is the indicator, and as I drag it this way, that part of the organ is going to grow more. And if I drag it this way, it's going to recede. And yeah, that's why that's happening. And so you suddenly understand it better as you start to teach it. And so teaching it makes you like way better at it, I think. And so it's really good for these fourth years to be teaching first and second years. And so but you're right, it's the resources involved, not just the machines, but the instructors and the standardized patients and then the time. And that's, again, a bit of a political question, you know, like, what are we going to flush out of the curriculum to make room for ultrasound? And then you get it dialed in there, and then you kind of let your foot off the gas for a couple of years. You think it's set, you go do something else, you come back, and then students don't know how to scan. You're like, what happened? Oh, they moved it out of the curriculum, you know, last month because, oh, no. You have to constantly feed in and water it in the curriculum, or somebody else will come along with something, their pet project that they want to do. Medical school.
Is there another wave of the revolution, Chris, that has to be fought also on reimbursement and economics? Is that also a driver? Like a look at emergency medicine, how strong are financial drivers? It's better clinical care, yes, but outside of value-based systems, sometimes that gets overlooked in the face of CMS, reimbursement, fee codes, professional fees, technical fees, this and that, right? How do you see, is that something that we have to fight as well?
Well, you know, all this financial stuff is like my whole world right now as a department chair. So I have a newfound appreciation for all this. And I can tell you that the American College of Emergency Physicians has been very active in advocating for the CPT code reimbursement for point of care ultrasound and the various CPT codes. Because, you know, here's the thing. We're talking about ultrasound in very sort of philosophical terms for this so far. But the reality is, when you put probe to patient and you are going to look under the skin line at what's going on below the surface, there's only a couple of ways to do that, you know, short of using a scalpel or ionizing radiation. So this is not the physical examination. This is not just listening, you know, with a stethoscope or feeling around the neck for something. I mean, that's the physical exam is nowhere in the same universe that imaging is when it comes to trying to find out what's, you know, really going on inside the body, which is why imaging is so exciting and fun place to be in all of medicine, whether it's ultrasound or otherwise. So for people to equate ultrasound with just, you know, a quick ultrasound or just take a quick look and they don't record the images, they don't make a report, it can go the way of the physical exam, which the latest Medicare reimbursement for emergency medicine, they basically said, yeah, the physical exam's not even, don't even bother doing it. You know, we're documenting it. We're not even going to look for the documentation anymore. We're just looking for your medical decision-making. And in that medical decision-making, you know, you can use point of care ultrasound as a way to explain what you were thinking and the things you were doing to rule things out to ensure that you're being reimbursed at the appropriate high level, or the ultrasound can contribute to the complexity of care that way, or it can contribute to the patient's overall bill with a separate procedure note. And so that's kind of what my specialty is trying to figure out right now. But you're right to be very concerned about this. I certainly am, because I hear people talk about, you know, especially outside of my specialty, in my specialty, people are usually pretty good about not doing this, but outside my specialty, everybody keeps talking about the physical exam and ultrasound and quick looks and all this stuff. And yes, I do teach ultrasound during the physical exam component of medical school, but it really is a very complex and important, legit imaging modality that deserves its own reimbursement and adds to the complexity of care. And for all the value-based things we talked about, maybe that's where it can reside somehow. But right now, and you know, going forward, we have to all be very cognizant of that this is a legit imaging modality, and failure to archive the images and make reports, it really doesn't do it the justice that it deserves and is kind of touching a nerve in a way when I hear someone.
I could see that. Well, I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I feel the same. And you know what? I think that's true of, you know, many new innovations, right? Is that, you know, it's kind of this combination of education, but also incentive alignment. And, you know, can you align the incentives to fully utilize it? And I really appreciate what you said, that it's much more than a quick look, which sometimes it is kind of branded as that in EMED in particular. And as such, then it's going to be very limited in its reimbursement versus doing a full strain analysis or a limited echo or something else that has a code, but has to be reported on and captured and archived in order for that justification to be brought forward. And so, you know, we've talked about some of the revolutions that have been fought, some that are ongoing, education, maybe some to come in the face of reimbursement. What about new frontiers of getting it, you know, further into the community? So now we're starting to really establish the use of ultrasound in hospitals. Could it jump the divide into primary care? Could it ultimately be in the hands of a patient? Again, maybe not to fully diagnose, but rather to monitor a condition. I always think of it in many ways of through the evolution that ECGs have gone. ECG is also an open-ended diagnostic platform. And yet, you know, some use cases have miniaturized the ECG and have focused on making it a yes-no machine for atrial fibrillation, for example. So could that also occur in ultrasound as it continues to move out from the hospital into the clinic and into the home?
Well, just looking at the primary care, you know, question first, I just, pretty big demand here. So my team and I love to teach and we love going and doing courses around the country and locally. And we were just approached by our own primary care doctors saying, hey, can you guys teach us? We want to learn this in our clinic. We have, you know, we've got the machines now. We really want to learn how they work. Sure. And it was like teaching ultrasound to emergency physicians, you know, 20 years ago. It was like super geeked out on it, asking all kinds of questions, really excited about how to deploy its use in their own patients. And, you know, you go back to talking about, you know, primary care, some ways very different than emergency medicine, but in some ways it's similar in the sense that, you know, they're seeing, you know, all comers and, you know, we take care of a lot of the same types of patients. It's just a difference in their chronicity. And you talk about congestive heart failure is just one example of how in the education and keeping a patient out of the hospital, that condition, primary care can play such a role here utilizing ultrasound and even taking it into the community and to the home, the patient home, which is more and more becoming a concept I'm hearing about all the time, you know, the medical home where a patient is avoiding the hospital at all costs and getting all their care provided to them at their house in various modalities. And point of care ultrasound just leans right in on this medical home thing very well. And so in the case of that CHF patient, you can imagine them taking the transducer, putting it on their lungs, and the AI tells them what to do, counts the B-lines.
Interstitial lung fluid, exactly, count the B-lines.
Yeah, and then
it can change the titration, right, instead of going into the ER.
Yeah, and basically what it does is it communicates wirelessly to their pills. You know, the prescription bottles, some of them have a Wi-Fi thing that suddenly unlocks them so they can open it up or dispenses another tablet. And so then it would just be like, put the ultrasound probe on, and then it's going to tell you, and then tablets come out of this thing that you take, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it just kind of completes the whole loop on that particular patient who happened to, you know, eat too much soup the night before that had a lot of salt in it because it was like a birthday celebration. You know, just life happens, and to stay out of the hospital is the goal. And where does ultrasound fit into that? I think it could fit in several different ways. And so
I agree that,
yeah, that could be the next revolution.
Yeah, maybe that really is the next frontier. And I think there's another body involved, which is now not CMS, but the FDA is the regulator to say, well, is it safe and effective to use in these use cases? And I think in order to do that, I really liked your thinking on this. We probably have to think of it more as a closed loop system, right? Not as an open-ended diagnostic, because I think the FDA would be very reticent to say, I'm going to let the patient self-diagnose themselves. They'll scan, they'll look at an image, and they'll make a decision, right? No, of course, that's not where the FDA would want to go. There's no mitigation to that. But if it was a closed loop system that was measuring a thing, was measuring the degree of interstitial lung fluid, was measuring whether there's a fetal heartbeat, right, for monitoring obstetrics, and therefore it's more binary and it's more closed loop. And maybe that the outcome of that measurement is one thing, like to your point, is dispensing a pill now to manage the titration or the hydration, as opposed to now creating a primary care visit or even an ER visit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to see that happen. Well, this is very exciting. And I really like kind of to think of it as really as in revolutionary terms. Just one thing I was curious, which department back in the political days, call it the 2000s, my perception was always radiology, was the toughest to kind of help them overcome the concern to say, what is this toy? Like, does it really have a role? And like, do we want people that are not sonographers picking up an ultrasound? Was that the hardest political breakthrough, or where do you find kind of where were the real battle lines drawn?
Yeah, I think in general, thinking back, I haven't thought about this in a while now, but thinking back in the cobwebs of the early in my career, the kind of conversations I was having, I think the radiologists were coming at us in the most respectful way possible, saying, we love that you're interested in imaging. We love that you love imaging too. However, we are concerned with the quality of the images that you're doing, and we're not really sure that you're doing it the right way. And we just, you know, if you're going to do this, you should do it right and not miss stuff and not, you know, curtail the exam to where a patient thinks they got an ultrasound and in the end, you know, you didn't get the right images and didn't document the right way and stuff, and phantom scans left to right and quick looks. And, you know, they had a lot of actually good points. And when they came at you nicely and respectfully and concerned just about the quality, forgetting about the billing for a minute, but just the quality, then I think that worked for me. I mean, I was like, yeah, you know, you bring up some good points. We really need to do this the right way. And I think that really helped the revolution in the right direction. But it was sometimes, though, it did turn into, about finances and about billing and, oh, you're going to be, you know, we're not going to get ultrasound referrals anymore. And there's a lot, some people were concerned about that aspect of it, which turned out not to be a real concern over time. And it was just more like some local areas were really, you know, sort of being more worried about the financial aspect of it. But for me, my politics were never with radiology. I always had really cool radiologists about it, and they understood, and we worked together and still do. And I have a radiologist who helps me teach ultrasound to medical students on the faculty there, and we teach courses together. And yeah, he's been amazing to work with and my whole career. But I've encountered some politics a little bit with the OB early on, but quite a bit from ophthalmology. And so ophthalmology really didn't want us doing ocular ultrasound on any patient who could have any consideration for trauma whatsoever, because we could be like pushing too hard and causing more trauma to the eye or infection, but was doing it in a way that was very like, you know, you need to shut this down. And it said just a lot of negative terms rather than saying wanting to learn more and wanting to teach. It was more like an aggressive political stance, but got through it. You know, like all politics, you can get through it as long as everybody keeps their guns in their holsters and you have nice conversations and be respectful and really try to get into the other person's frame and say back, you know, to them what their frame is.
What I'm hearing.
Yeah, that's it. And like, okay, I understand. No, that makes sense. And here's my frame too. And I think that's, you know, leadership stuff there. But yeah, but not anymore. I don't have any politics with it, at least not locally. I haven't even, it's not even a whiff of it in probably 5 years. So
that's so good to hear. Really encouraging. Chris, we covered so much ground today. Wow. From your background as a doctor coming into emergency medicine, choosing the academic pathway, getting into ultrasound, and then becoming this kind of father of the revolution. I can almost see like a flag, kind of like a focus flag, like draped around your shoulder, holding like an ultrasound, like unite, and really learned a lot. Thank you so much for everything you do. I think you've really been a beacon for the industry, and we need more geeky, ultrasound loving doctors like you. Hopefully, I can also help you on your journey by getting you to that 50th state.
Significant coverage in North Dakota.
We're going to do a social media push to get this podcast. Just before we wrap things up, if our audience wants to learn more about you and everything you do, where should they go? Where can they find out more about Chris Fox?
So my Twitter handle is at jchristianfox. My first name's John. It's kind of annoying. I go by my middle name, Chris, short for Christian. So it's jchristianfox is my Twitter handle. And I also have a very basic YouTube channel too, with some of my videos, some of my educational videos on it as well. I don't know my YouTube channel. I think it might be, it's also jchristianfox. That's my my Gmail address, jchristianfox@gmail.com. That's probably my YouTube channel too. I should look that up before you had this. But yeah, so sometimes I Google myself and I find the YouTube channel right away. And then that's when I start sending out links to some of the videos that I've uploaded there. But yeah, that's it. I've been at UC Irvine. Another way to find me. I've been here for 22 years and hopefully another 15 more until they get rid of me. So,
Amen. Chris, again, wonderful to have you. Thanks so much. And then to all of our listeners, as always, we appreciate our time together. And be sure to catch us on the next episode of our podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Medical Imaging for All podcast, brought to you by Clarius. If you enjoyed today's show, please do us a favor and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. For the latest episodes, please visit www.clarius.com or search Medical Imaging for All on your podcast platform of choice. Thanks again, and we'll catch you on the next episode.